And welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. And I hope everybody had a great solstice. Tonight's topics will be the celebration of the solstice called Midsummer. I have a short commentary on Jews. We'll get into why Hypatia was murdered and why Luciferians hate Christians and Christianity. Pagan Jesus, time permitting, maybe some other stuff, we'll see. What I'm going to do is try to get as much in as I can, time allotted. If I finish early, I may get into something, or I may just call it quits. If I don't finish, it will be continued on the next show. And hopefully you have caught some of my recent shows, so you will know what's going on when you hear this show. If you haven't, pause, stop, go back, listen to the other ones, and then come back to this one. For the record, today is June 23rd, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 2 degrees Cancer. Be sure and give a listen to all of the other hosts here on Renegade. We have Kyle on Mondays, Lou on Tuesdays, Dana on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Siegfried on Fridays, Roundtable on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sundays. I will not monitor the chat. As usual, I may glance at it during music breaks, and I'll be drinking and smoking where I'm sitting. So we'll have the usual momentary pauses at times for some coughing. Anyway, we have a chat at renegadebroadcasting.com. We have another chat at renegadebroadcasting.chitango.com. And the same chat exists over at alternativesocial.com. I want to remind everybody about nationalprotectionism.com. Again, I have no personal website or blog. Probably wouldn't have a life if I did. No calls tonight. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. And that is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my email list, just send me an email saying subscribe. Or just write me. I can't guarantee I can get to all of the emails. And tonight I have the cat sitting right here next to me for a change. So I wanted to mention one thing briefly. I got kicked off of a Facebook group again this week. Another notch on my belt. Everybody just loves me to death, I tell you. And this was a white group, too. They didn't like what I had to say. And there was some Greek woman in there trying to poke fun at Texas and bragging about how things were going in Greece. I could have rubbed it in and said, well, you know, until you get to where Iceland is, you ain't shit. Yeah, for all you know, your people there that you've got seated are just there for show, or they're going to be bought off in time, or they will, they're there for a reason, and that's why they're allowed to be there. And, of course, you know, Christianity. Oh, we can't criticize Christianity. And there was some Christian on there who was trying to use the Bible to defend his beliefs. So you know how it goes if you listen to my shows. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. Hopefully some of them will be listening to this show tonight. We'll see, but I doubt it. We're gonna lose if white people just don't get their damn head together and get rid of this damn mind virus. You know, I mean, we've got pagans and atheists that still think like Christians. Big problem here. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play another song, and we'll get into the topics of the evening. Be right back. We'll be right back. They don't have Stevie Ray Vaughan in Greece. Okay, I'm going to get into the summer solstice celebration. And typically this varies, you know, a little bit depending upon the calendar. You know, it's usually around June 21st when the sun enters Cancer. So anyway, I've got a little essay here. And this came from The Joy of Satan. Let me just go ahead and begin. The summer solstice, 666. Technically, the summer solstice begins when the sun enters 0 degrees of the zodiac sign of Cancer. The summer solstice is one of the four major solar festivals of the year, the others being the winter solstice of December 21st, when the sun enters 0 degrees of Capricorn, and the other two being the spring equinox, when the sun enters 0 degrees of Aries, in the fall equinox when the sun enters 0 degrees of Libra. All of the satanic, or originally pagan, of course, this everything that's pagan was originally satanic. All of the satanic holidays have been corrupted and replaced with false and imposter biblical characters, fictitious legends, and practices completely unrelated to the original holidays. This was done by the Catholic Church for the sole purpose to remove spirituality and occult knowledge. In addition to the satanic holidays being times for festivals and celebrations, these days are certain points where astral communications are greatly facilitated and witchcraft workings are greatly enhanced, depending on the holiday, of course. Beneath all is alchemy. For those working on the magnum opus and or to advance their own powers and soul, these days are very important for different aspects of the working. For example, the magnum opus should be commenced at 3 a.m. on the day the sun enters the sign of Aries. This is where the Lamb of God was stolen from the zodiac sign of Aries, the ram, and Chiro runic staves, or Chiro runic staves, I'm not sure, that are often seen in paintings and such depicting the fake Nazarene. The summer solstice was replaced by the Catholic Church with the Feast of St. John. 666 is the number for the sun. It represents amplification of astral solar power. The heart chakra esoterically is ruled by the sun. On the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, etc. of June, when the sun enters Cancer, depends on the day again, the power of the sun is drastically amplified. Workings that deal with solar magic are greatly enhanced at this time. Workings on both the heart and solar plexus chakra are greatly enhanced at this time as well. Communications with astral entities such as elementals, fairies, gnomes, etc. are greatly enhanced at this time. As with Halloween, the astral is very thin, and communications with demons is much easier. And that holiday is also known as Samhain, and it's spelled Samhain. And by the way, there's a little chart. If you're not on Blog Talk already, and you look at the images that are on there for the show, and put your cursor of your mouse over the image, it'll pause. You can see the solar wheel with all of the witches' sabbats and the holidays that we should be celebrating in our society, but are not. At least some of them we are, but not in the manner that we should be. So it'll give you a better idea of what's going on. And by the way, this holiday is also typically referred to as Midsummer. And I'll go ahead and mention all the rest of them. We have Midsummer, which is typically around summer solstice. And there's Lugnasadha, that's Lugnasadh. Notice the word Lu in there. That's around August 1st. And we have Mabon, which is around September 21st of the fall equinox. And then we have Samhain on All Hallows Eve, so to speak, December 31st. Then we have Yule at the winter solstice. Then we have Imbolc around February 2nd. And then we have Ostara around the spring equinox. And then we have Beltane and the Feast of Alberg, which is April 30th and May 1st. And so anyway, let me go ahead and kill that chart here. Okay, back to the essay here. Some of the things that typically are dealt with at this time are fire magic is greatly facilitated. The eve of the summer solstice has a very long tradition for being a night where divination is much easier and more accurate. Love magic spells are also greatly enhanced on the eve of summer solstice. This is also an excellent, powerful time for infusing herbs, crystals, and other items with solar energy. This date is also favored for the beginning of any healing work, as the sun is the esoteric healer. Workings that deal with infusing water with solar and or healing energy are also traditionally done at this time. Creating and blessing of wands or fire, blessing of the tarot cards. Rune spells and rune work are also favored at this time, as runes are staves and of the element of fire, as well as the gathering of herbs for magic, especially those used for solar or fire magic, and or healing. In ancient times, festivities and celebrations of this important holiday nearly always include Baal fires, B-A-A-L, the traditional bonfire. Notice the word bon, B-O-N, and Baal, B-A-A-L. I've discussed those in some previous shows. The element of fire represents the life force and life itself. Death is cold and hard. Fire is warmth and life. Those of us who have condensed the life force within ourselves know just how hot it can be, like the Kundalini serpent. The traditional color for the festival is white. Some of the festivities usually involve circle dancing, snake dancing, sexual orgies, indulgence, and feasting are all traditions for the summer solstice. The tradition of lighting the Baal fire and jumping through it has survived since the ancient times. Despite the church's attempts to stamp out all pagan traditions, the lighting of a midsummer bonfire on Midsummer's Eve survived in even the most staunchly Christian communities. The ancient Druids celebrated the unification of heaven and earth. What this means is centering on the heart chakra. Heaven and earth were stolen from Taoism and are code words for the crown or heaven chakra and the base or earth chakra. In some doctrines, hell is the code word for the base chakra, with earth at the heart chakra. But for the unification referred to here, this is the unification of the energies of the base and crown convened at the heart. The uniting of both elements, water and fire, are celebrated on this day. And some people who are into this will also do voodoo rituals, and they're traditional at this time as well, and they have survived for centuries. Additionally, let's see here. There's a quote. It says, immediately the drums increased the tempo. The singers chanted the ritual song, and a woman dancer stepped into the circle and began the ritual dance in imitation of the movements of the snake. In the frenzied group dance which followed, the dancers tore off their clothing and danced nude until the ritual ended, as it always did, in a sexual orgy. Okay, I've got to deal with my dog right at the moment, who's being a pest. This won't take but just a second, but I've got a little short clip here that I uploaded for just such an occasion. So hang on just one sec.
Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Okay, I'm back. Most of you know that. That's from the movie Pulp Fiction. I just think it sounds interesting. Anyway, all right, the next topic is an article I have here on Jews, and this was posted in the Joy of Satan, and I thought I would mention this as well, because it's rather interesting. Begin. The Jews are a dualistic system with one core. The Jews themselves at the core are a genetic group, a bloodline. Yet one can convert to Judaism. But upon this, they have to marry into the genetic group and absorb their genes into the hive. This allows the Jews to blend into the holy society, the host society, while still maintaining their genetic psychic strength. And the convert becomes an active agent of the Jews. with a Gentile face, but will never be allowed to go far within the deep ranks of Judaism. At the highest levels, only those of purest Jewish genetic lines, can be admitted, making sure the pure-blooded ones lead the group and give it direction. The Jews, by their records and texts, such as the Zohar, state they come from a genetic line not of the Gentiles, which they believe makes them superior and gives them entitlement to the planet and all upon it. They state Gentiles are animals put here to be their slaves and property. And since we are not from their line, we are not human and not covered by their laws of the Torah, meaning they can do what they want to us with no moral qualms. Judaism dehumanizes the entire planet. Above the Jews are a collective of negative entities who the top rabbinical class, who are adept at black magic, work with and take direction from. The Jews carry the spiritual inheritance of these entities in their blood, as this is the group they are genetically created from by their own admission. What this means is they are connected on the deep soul level to such non- and anti-human entities. They are a window to these beings on the planet. Even the average Jew has a deep unconscious connection to these beings on the soul level, and they are bound into a large mass Jewish mind or collective unconscious and consciousness they share with such entities as well. They share the same race soul together. Their soul nature is encoded in their religious texts, of which are nothing but what is in their soul, and simply the desire to harm, enslave, murder, and destroy Gentiles by any means. Their biology is their belief. People point to their different factions, disagreements, and infighting as to something to offer an example of something to believe the Jews are not a mono group against us. But this shows nothing in many cases, as it proves the opposite. It's in their soul, and even programs started by Jews in conflict with other Jews. They still push the Jewish agenda anyway and harm Gentiles. This above belief, not all bad apples belief, creates a false understanding that allows Jews to step in and control the opposition to them, as well as terraforming it into something which serves them, which means you can never trust them. Many do what they do unconsciously, because that's in their soul, and that is what it's about. And it is their soul, in their soul, to do what their religious texts state. It's not about opposition to Christianity, Islam, communism, liberalism, capitalism, Zionism, etc. It's actually on the deeply conscious and honest level. One thing only, opposition to Judaism. All of these programs listed above come out of the Jewish race soul. Most people in our society are in strong opposition to the Jews on some level and don't even realize it yet. One can also observe strong schizogenic behaviors in those who are larger admixtures of Gentile blood. It's from a conflict on the soul level which manifests into the conscious mind. Otto Weininger stands out. He was half Jewish, but hated his Jewish half as an ugly and vile strain within his soul. He could feel this. He lived a life of struggle with it till he killed himself to try to escape it. He was an open example of the two different and conflicting natures of the Gentile and Jewish soul in one man, and the fact those of Jewish blood can never stop being Jewish, even if they consciously want to. It's in their soul. The purpose of Judaism is to terraform the planet into a situation where the entities that manifested the Jew can then feed off humans and use them as slaves without end. The Jews are simply the terrestrial level of this agenda. In lay terms, the Jews are a race of psychopaths, and not part of any Gentile humanity. They are a war upon it. Okay, let me go back to the studio here, and I'm going to play one more song, and we'll get into the major topics of this evening.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm back. Now, what I'm going to get into next was the murder of Hypatia. And there was a reason why they murdered her, these evil Christians. They have a lot to hide. And we're going to get into that tonight. And I'm just going to go ahead and start reading this first part here. When I say first part, meaning the murder of Hypatia. We'll get into pagan Jesus afterwards. Also, too, if you are at Block Talk Radio, there's an image in there of a pentangle, and it contains an image in it of a fish, some Hebrew letters, and the Seal of Solomon, or the Star of David, or from the proper way, because they stole it, just a hexagram. So anyway, I'll begin here. The murder of Hypatia. We must not forget that the Christian church owes its present canonical gospels, and hence its whole religious dogma, to the Sortes Sanctorum. Okay, now that's, I'm going to go to Wikipedia and elaborate on that a little bit, because that came ultimately from the Sortes Homericae, and the Sortes Virgilianae, at Virgilianae, probably meaning Virgil. So, anyway, the Sortes Virgilianae, according to Wikipedia, is a form of divination by bibliomancy in which advice or predictions of the future are sought by randomly selecting a passage from Virgil's Aeneid, A-E-N-E-I-D. It was most widely practiced in the later Roman Empire and in medieval times. It seems to have been modeled on the ancient Roman Sortes, as seen in the Sortes Homericae, and then later in the Sortes Sanctorum. Now, I'm going to read the Sortes Homericae. The Sortes Homericae was a practice of drawing a random sentence or line from the works of Homer, usually the Iliad, to answer a question or predict the future. Socrates is recorded as doing so in prison to determine the day of his execution, and the practice even occurred in the Renaissance era. In the Roman world, it coexisted with the various forms of the Sortes, S-O-R-T-E-S, such as the Sortes Virgilianae and their Christian successor, the Sortes Sanctorum. Now, what it says about the Sortes Sanctorum. It says, was a type of divination or cleromancy practiced in early Christianity, derived and adapted from the ancient Sortes, S-O-R-T-E-S, as seen in the pagan Sortes Homerica and Sortes Virgilianae. Some early Christians went to church and listened for the words of Scripture that they were being sung, that were being sung when they entered the church, as a random means of predicting the future and God's will. This is along the lines of the Jewish Bath Kol form of divination. But the Sortes, of course, Jewish. But the Sortes was done more formally, by casually opening the Holy Scripture and reading the first words to come to hand, with these words being taken to foretell the inquirer's fate. Doing so was often a public event, and sometimes accompanied by ceremonies. So anyway, let's see here. Yeah, I'll go ahead and read the rest of this. Ceremonies such as the 7th century emperor Heraclius, H-E-R-A-C-L-I-U-S, ordering three days public fast before a consultation as to whether or not he should advance or retreat against the Persians. He took the text that arose as the divine instruction to writer in Albania. Since full copies of the Christian Bible were rare before printing was invented, the lots usually used the Psalms, the Prophets, or the four Gospels. Okay, so that answers what that is. Now, we're going to go back to this, and I'm going to read that first sentence again. We must not forget that the Christian church owes its present canonical Gospels, and hence its whole religious dogmatism, to the Sortes Sanctorum. Unable to agree as to which were the most divinely inspired of the numerous Gospels extant in its time, the mysterious Council of Nicaea concluded to leave the decision of the puzzling question to miraculous intervention. This Nicene Council may well be called mysterious. There was a mystery. First, in the mystical number of its 318 bishops, on which Barnabas lays such a stress. Added to this, there is no agreement among ancient writers as to the time and place of its assembly, nor even to the bishop who presided. Notwithstanding the grandiloquence, grandiloquent, eulogium of Constantine, notwithstanding the eulogium of Constantine, Sabinus, the bishop of Heraclea, affirms that, except Constantine, the emperor, and Eusebius Pamphilus, these bishops were a set of illiterate, simple creatures that understood nothing, which is equivalent to saying that they were a set of fools. Such was apparently the opinion entertained of them by Pappus, P-A-P-P-U-S, who tells us of the bit of magic resorted to decide which were the true Gospels. In his Synodicon to the Council, Pappus says, having promiscuously put all the books that were referred to the Council for determination under a communion table in a church, they, meaning the bishops, besought the Lord that they inspired writings, that the inspired writings might get upon the table while the spurious ones remained underneath, and it happened accordingly. But we are not told who kept the key of the council chamber overnight. On the authority of ecclesiastical eyewitnesses, therefore, we are at liberty to say that the Christian world owes its word of God to a method of divination for resorting to which the church subsequently condemned unfortunate victims as conjurers, enchanters, magicians, witches, vaticinators, and burnt them by thousands. In treating of this truly divine phenomenon of the self-sorting manuscripts, the fathers of the church say that God himself presides over the sorties. As we have shown elsewhere, Augustine confesses that he himself used this sort of divination. But opinions, like revealed religions, are liable to change. That which for nearly 1,500 years was imposed on Christendom as a book, of which every word was written under the direct supervision of the Holy Ghost, of which not a syllable nor a comma could be changed without sacrilege, is now being retranslated, revised, corrected, and clipped of whole verses, in some cases of entire chapters. And yet, as soon as the new edition is out, its doctors would have us accept it as a new revelation of this century, with the alternative of being held as an infidel. Thus we see that no more within than without its precincts is the infallible church to be trusted more than would be reasonably convenient. The forefathers of our modern divines found authority for the sorties in the verse where it said, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." And now their direct heirs hold that the whole disposing thereof is of the devil. Perhaps they are unconsciously beginning to endorse the doctrine of Syrian Bardesanes, that the action of God as well as of man are subject to necessity. At the beginning of the 4th century, crowds began gathering at the door of the academy where the learned and unfortunate Hypatia expounded the doctrines of the divine Plato and Platonus, and thereby impeded the progress of Christian proselytism. She too successfully dispelled the mist hanging over the religious mysteries invented by the fathers not to be considered dangerous. Thus alone would have been sufficient to imperil both herself and her followers. It was precisely the teachings of this pagan philosopher which had been so freely borrowed by the Christians to give a finishing touch to their otherwise incomprehensible scheme. That they seduced so many into joining the new religion, and now the Platonic light began shining so inconveniently bright upon the pious patchwork as to allow everyone to see whence the revealed doctrines were derived. But there was a still greater peril. Hypatia had studied under Plutarch, the head of the Athenian school, and had learned all the secrets of the Theurgy. While she lived to instruct the multitude, no divine miracles could be produced before one could divulge the natural causes by which they took place. Her doom was sealed by Cyril, C-Y-R-I-L, whose eloquence she eclipsed, and whose authority, built on degrading superstitions, had to yield before hers, which was erected on the rock of immutable natural law. It is more than curious that Cave, the author of the Lives of the Fathers, should find it incredible that Cyril sanctioned her murder on account of his general character. A saint who will sell the gold and silver vessels of his church, and then, after spending the money, lie at his trial as he did. Many may well be suspected of anything. Besides, in this case, the church had to fight for her life, to say nothing of her future supremacy. Alone, the hated and erudite pagan scholars and the no less learned Gnostics held in their doctrines the hitherto concealed wires of all these theological marionettes. Once the curtain should be lifted, the connection between the old pagan and the new Christian religions would be exposed, and then what would have become of the mysteries into which it is a sin and blasphemy to pry? With such a coincidence of the astronomical allegories of various pagan myths, with the dates adopted by Christianity for the Nativity, Crucifixion, and Resurrection, and such an identity of rites and ceremonies, what would have been the fate of the new religion had not the Church, under the pretext of serving Christ, got rid of the two well-informed philosophers? To guess what, if the coup d'etat had then failed, might have been the prevailing religion in our own century would indeed be a hard task. But in all probability, the state of things which made of the Middle Ages a period of intellectual darkness, which degraded the nations of the Occident and lowered the European of those days almost to the level of a paupin savage, could not have occurred. I need to cough. Hold on. The fears of the Christians were but too well founded, and their pious zeal and prophetic insight was rewarded from the very first. In the demolition of the Serapeum, after the bloody riot between the Christian mob and the pagan worshippers had ended with the interference of the emperor, a Latin cross of a perfect Christian shape was discovered honed upon the granite slabs of the Adytum, A-D-Y-T-U-M. This was a lucky discovery, indeed, and the monks did not fail to claim that the cross had been hallowed by the pagans in a spirit of prophecy. At least Sozomen, with an air of triumph, records the fact. But archaeology and symbolism, those tireless and implacable enemies of clerical false pretenses, have found in their hieroglyphs of the legend running around the design at least a partial interpretation of its meaning. According to King and other numismatists and archaeologists, the cross was placed there as the symbol of eternal life. Such a Tau, T-A-U, or Egyptian cross was used in the Bacchic and Eleusinian mysteries. All right, let me start that over there. Lost my spot temporarily. Such a Tau or Egyptian cross was used in the Bacchic and Eleusinian mystery, symbol of the dual generative power. It was laid upon the breast of the initiate after his new birth was accomplished, and the Mystae, that's M-Y-S-T-A-E, had returned from their baptism in the sea. It was a mystic sign that his spiritual birth had regenerated and united his astral soul with his divine spirit, and that he was ready to ascend in spirit to the blessed abodes of light and glory, the Eleusinia. And refer to my discussions on the Kundalini. The towel was a magic talisman at the same time as a religious emblem. It was adopted by the Christians through the Gnostics and Kabbalists, who used it largely, as their numerous gems testify, and who had the towel from the Egyptians and the Latin cross from the Buddhist missionaries who brought it from India, where it can be found until now, 2 or 3 centuries B.C. The Assyrians, Egyptians, ancient Americans, Hindus, and Romans had it in various but slightly modifications of shape. Till very late in the medieval ages, it was considered a potent spell against epilepsy and demonical possession, and the signet of the living God brought down in St. John's vision by the angel ascending from the east to seal the servants of our God in their foreheads. But was the same mystic Tau, T-A-U, the Egyptian cross. In the painted glass of St. Dionysus in France, this angel is represented as stamping this sign on the forehead of the elect. The legend reads, Signum Te, S-I-G-N-U-M-T-A-Y. In King's Gnostics, and I believe that's a book, the author reminds us that this mark is commonly borne by St. Anthony, an Egyptian recluse. What the real meaning of the towel was is explained to us by the Christian St. John, the Egyptian Hermes, and the Hindu Brahmins. But it is too evident that, with the apostle, at least, it meant the ineffable name, as he calls this signet of the living God. A few chapters further on, the Father's name written in her foreheads. And be sure and refer back to my shows on Buddhism, because you're going to need it to understand a lot of what's going to be discussed tonight. The Brahmatma, the chief of the Hindu initiates, had on his headgear 2 keys, symbol of the revealed mystery of life and death, placed cross-like, and in some Buddhist pagodas of Tartary in Mongolia, the entrance of a chamber within the temple generally contained the staircase which leads to the inner Daghoba, and the porticos of some Prachida, P-R-A-C-H-I-D-A, are ornamented with a cross formed of 2 fishes, and is found on some of the zodiacs of the Buddhists. We should not wonder at all at learning the sacred device in the tombs in the catacombs at Rome, the Vesica Pisces, or Pisces, depending on which way you want to spell the word, was derived from the said Buddhist zodiacal sign. How general must have been the geometrical figure in the world symbols may be inferred from the fact that there is a Masonic tradition that Solomon's temple was built on 3 foundations, forming the triple Tau, or 3 crosses. In its mystical sense, the Egyptian cross owes its origin as an emblem to the realization by the earliest philosophy of an androgynous dualism of every manifestation in nature, which proceeds from the abstract ideal of a likewise androgynous deity, while the Christian emblem is simply due to chance. Had the Mosaic law prevailed, Jesus should have been lapidated. The crucifix was an instrument of torture and utterly common among Romans, as it was unknown among Semitic nations. It was called the Tree of Infamy. It is but later that it was adopted as a Christian symbol, and I discussed that in my last show. But during the first 2 decades, the apostles looked upon it with horror. It is certainly not the Christian cross that John had in mind when speaking of the signet of the living God, but the mystic Tau, T-A-U, the tetragrammaton, or mighty name, which on the most ancient Kabbalistic talismans was represented by the 4 Hebrew letters composing the Holy Word. Now, of course, these are Jews. Keep that in mind. I need to call. Hold on. The famous Lady Ellenborough, known among the Arabs of Damascus and in the desert after her last marriage as Hanaum, I can't pronounce this, it's Arabic, Hanaum Medjoui, Hanoum Medjoui, had a talisman in her possession presented to her by a Druze from Mount Lebanon. It was recognized by a certain sign on its left corner to belong to that class of gems, which is known in Palestine as a messianic amulet of the 2nd and 3rd century BCE. It is a green stone of a pentagonal form. At the bottom is engraved a fish. Higher is Solomon's seal. And of course, Christians who do not know anything about Hebrew magic will not grasp what the Solomon seal actually is. And I'm not going to sit here and discuss Hebrew sorcery tonight. But look at the image on the Block Talk Radio provided for this show. So anyway, let me read part of that. At the bottom is an engraved fish, higher, Solomon seal, and still higher, the four Chaldaic letters, Yod, He, Vau, He, or I-H-A-O, which form the name of the deity. These are arranged in quite an unusual way, running from below upward in reversed order and forming the Egyptian Tau, T-A-U. Around these, there is a legend, which, as the gem is not our property, we are not at liberty to give. The Tau, in its mystical sense, as well as the crux and ansata, is the tree of life. It is well known that the earliest Christian emblems, before it was ever attempted to represent the bodily appearance of Jesus, were the lamb, the good shepherd, and the fish. The origin of the latter emblem, which has so puzzled the archaeologists, thus becomes comprehensible. The whole secret lies in the easily ascertained fact that, while in the Kabbalah, the King Messiah is called interpreter or revealer of the mystery, and shown to be the fifth emanation in the Talmud, for reasons which we will now explain, the Messiah is very often designated as Dag, D-A-G, or the fish. This is an inheritance from the Chaldees, and relates, as the very name indicates, to the Babylonian Dagon, the man-fish, who was the instructor and interpreter of the people to whom he appeared. Abarbanel explains the name by stating that the sign of his coming, meaning the Messiah, is the conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter in the sign Pisces. Therefore, as the Christians were intent upon identifying their Christos with the Messiah of the Old Testament, they adopted it so readily as to forget that its true origin might be traced still farther back than the Babylonian Dagon. How eagerly and closely the ideal of Jesus was united by the early Christians with every imaginable Kabbalistic and pagan tenet may be inferred from the language of Clemens of Alexandria addressed to his brother co-religionists. Oh, I need to cough. When they were debating upon the choice of the most appropriate symbol to remind them of Jesus, Clemens advised them in the following words, "Let the engraving upon the gem of your ring be either a dove or a ship running before the wind, or the argha, A-R-G-H-A, or a fish." Was the good father, when writing the sentence, laboring under the recollection of Joshua, son of Nun, called Jesus, in the Greek and Slavonian versions, or had he forgotten the real interpretation of these pagan symbols? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and stop at this point here. No, wait a minute. Let me go ahead and finish this paragraph. And actually, the next one, too. I'm sorry. I just saw something in here that I wanted to bring up. I thought I had reached the point where I had planned. Apparently not. Okay. So, now. There we go. Joshua, son of Nun, or Nave, or Navis, could have with perfect propriety adopted the image of a ship or even a fish, for Joshua means Jesus, son of the fish god, but it was really too hazardous to connect the emblems of Venus, Astarte, and all of the Hindu goddesses, the Argha, dove, and fish, with the immaculate birth of their god. This looks very much as if in the early days of Christianity, but little difference was made between Christ, Bacchus, Apollo, and the Hindu Krishna, the incarnation of Vishnu, with whose first avatar this symbol of the fish originated. In the Hara Purana, in the Bhagavad Gita, as well as in several other books, the god Vishnu is shown as having assumed the form of a fish with a human head in order to reclaim the Vedas lost during the deluge. Having enabled Visvamitra to escape with all his tribe in the ark, Vishnu, pitying weak and ignorant humanity, remained with them for some time. It was this god who taught them to build houses, cultivate the land, and to thank the unknown deity whom he represented by building temples and instituting a regular worship, and as he remained half fish, half man all the time, at every sunset he used to return to the ocean wherein he passed the night. It is, says the sacred book, who taught men, after the diluvium, all that was necessary for their happiness. One day he plunged into the water and returned no more, for the earth had covered itself again with vegetation, fruit, and cattle. But he had taught the Brahmas the secret of all things, and that is from the Ha Purana. So far we see in this narrative the double of the story given by the Babylonian Berosus about Oannes, O-A-N-N-E-S, the fishman, who is no other than Vishnu. Unless indeed we have to believe that it was a Chaldee who civilized India. Okay, two more paragraphs. We say again, we desire to give nothing on our sole authority. Therefore, we cite Jack Elliott, who, however, criticized and contradicted on other points, and however loose he may be in the matter of chronology, even though in this he is nearer right than in those scientists who would have all Hindu books written since the Council of Nicaea, at least cannot be denied the reputation of a good Sanskrit scholar. And he says, while analyzing the word Oan, O-A-N, or Anus, that O in Sanskrit is an interjection expressing an invocation, as O Swayam Bhuva, O God, and an is a radical signifying in Sanskrit a spirit, a being, and we presume what the Greeks meant by the word daemon, D-E-M-O-N, a semigod. And remember, the demons are the gods of the Gentiles. What an extraordinary antiquity, he remarks, this fable of Vishnu, disguised as a fish, gives to the sacred books of the Hindus, especially in presence of the fact that the Vedas and Manu reckon more than 25,000 years of existence, as proved by the most serious as the most authentic documents. Few people, says the learned Halad, have their annals more authentic or serious than the Hindus. And this gets into all sorts of other analogies here. I'm going to go ahead and stop and take a little break before we get to the big topic of the night, pagan Jesus. So anyway, as you can see, why Hypatia had to be murdered. They could not let the cat out of the bag so they could plan their thus 2,000 years of tyranny. So, anyway, we'll listen to some Nine Inch Nails for a few minutes. Fire! Okay, I'm back. One more thing before I get started on pagan Jesus here. I wanted to read this one thing on the Sortes Sanctorum. By the way, that's Latin. It means lot and holy, like holy lot. And this is another definition from another place. It's actually, I think, a little bit better. It gives more insight into how they went about determining what books to have in there. Divination of the Holy Ones, the oracular responses, sayings, or prophecies of the oracles. In a more popular sense, the mere casting of lots or the attempt to ascertain the future by methods which have been popular throughout the ages. Divination was sometimes resorted to in the early Christian church and sanctioned even by Augustine with the proviso that it must be used only for pure and lofty purposes. Yeah. One manner probably consisted in picking a passage in Holy Writ after praying for divine guidance. In the ancient sanctuaries, however, a genuine divination was practiced by actual seers who based their operations upon mathematics and on the fact that nature foreshadows what is to come to pass. Because her processes are regulated by law and are consistent sequences of phenomena connected in a causal chain from spiritual originants. Thus, the ancient seer or forecaster, taking almost any natural occurrence or series of them, could from his trained faculties forecast that the present series of events in nature were inevitably leading towards. To do this successfully, one would have to be a genuine seer, which means employing the awakened intuition and spiritual clairvoyance which lie latent in most human beings. Isn't that special? Okay. Now, before I get into the thrust of the show here tonight, I'm going to say a few things. This is more or less what I think you could refer to as essentially esoteric and exoteric, as well as some comparative theology. And having had a couple of shows just recently done by me on Buddhism, this should, if you heard those shows, that should come in handy, as ultimately what I'm going to read tonight is sort of a Hellenized Buddhism. And ultimately, you can say that you will essentially understand, after all is said and done, that this is really a Luciferian doctrine, and Christians don't have a clue, of course. And it really is related to Semiramis, which I may do some info on a show at some point in the future, and the Babylonian mystery religion, which it gets referred to a lot in the Patriot movement, or the CRAP, as David Lane calls it, Christian Right American Patriots. And let's see here. I'm kind of looking at my notes as I'm reading this. You're going to have to kind of presume here. This is just an FYI. This is an old article, and it was written before we knew some things today. Like, it's pretty damn clear now that Jesus never existed, okay? But this author is writing on the basis that he did. And this author is also writing on the basis that Josephus was a real person and not a pen name of someone of the Flavian Roman court. Hold on, I got a cough. And also, we know now that the town of Nazareth did not exist at the time that Jesus supposedly lived. And we'll understand where Nazareth and Nazarene and all that kind of comes from here in just a second. But you see, the Luciferians hate Christians, and they hate Christianity because it is a perversion of their beliefs or their mysticism or their analogies that they use to convey spiritual information. And if you'll recall, the Jews accused Jesus of being a sorcerer. Correct? So anyway, let me light a smoke here real quick, and we'll get into this. I think you will find this very interesting. These are culled. This is all culled. And there's about 12 web pages here. I don't know how long it's going to take. If I can get this done in the next 45 minutes, I will, but I doubt it will be done in 45 minutes. It will certainly most likely run in to the archives. And so to hear all of it, you will need to download the archives and catch the whole show. Again, I'm either going to just keep going until I finish, or 3 hours, which means I will be forced to stop, whichever comes first. Or if I just can't continue for some reason, I will pick up on the next show. So let me get this smoke lit. So essentially, what we're going to learn here is that Jesus really was an initiate of the mystery schools and was also the level of a teacher. So anyway, let's begin. Facts are stronger, sometimes, than the strongest faith. All that the Jews learned, they had from older nations than themselves. The Chaldean Magi were their masters in the secret doctrine, and it was during the Babylonian captivity that they learned its metaphysical as well as practical tenets. The Nazars were a class of Chaldean therapists. Remember the therapeutes? Okay. We will show further that Jesus belonged to this class of Nazars, a class of Chaldean therapists. Pliny mentions three schools of Magi, one that he shows to have been founded at an unknown antiquity, the other established by Austenes and Zoroaster, the third by Moses and Yambres. And all the knowledge possessed by these different schools were Magian, Egyptian, or Jewish, was derived from India, or rather from both sides of the Himalayas. Many a lost secret lies buried under waste of sand in the Gobi Desert of eastern Turkmenistan. And the wise men of Khotan have preserved the strange traditions and knowledge of alchemy. Baron Bunsen shows that the origin of the ancient prayers and hymns of the Egyptian Book of the Dead is anterior to Menes and belong probably to the pre-Menite dynasty of Abydos between 3100 and 4500 BCE. The learned Egyptologist makes the era of Mendes or national empire as not later than 3059 BCE and demonstrates that the system of Osirian worship and mythology was already formed before this era of Menes. Egypt's Place in Universal History, Volume 5, page 94. We find in the hymns of this scientifically established pre-Edenic epoch, for Bunsen carries us back several centuries beyond the year of the creation of the world, 4004 BCE, as fixed by biblical chronology, precise lessons of morality, identical in substance and nearly so in form of expression, with those preached by Jesus in his Sermon on the Mount. And again, I reckon Christianity to be Hellenized, bastardized Buddhism. We give the authority of the most eminent Egyptologist and Aerologist for our statement. The inscriptions of the 12th dynasty are filled with ritualistic formula, says Bunsen. Extracts from the Hermetic books are found on monuments of the earliest dynasties and on those of the 12th dynasty. Portions of an earlier ritual are by no means uncommon. To feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, clothe the naked, bury the dead, formed the first duty of a pious man. The doctrine of the immortality of the soul is as old as this period. You can reference that in a tablet in the British Museum, number 562. And far older, perhaps, it dates from the time when the soul was objective, an objective being, hence when it could hardly be denied by itself, when humanity was a spiritual race and death existed not. The Kohen Novi lived in Egypt, where Jesus passed his early youth. They were usually confounded with the Therapeutae, who were a branch of this widely spread society. Such is the opinion of Godfrey Higgins and de Ribauld. After the downfall of the principal sanctuaries, which had already begun in the days of Plato, the many different sects, such as the Gymnosophists and the Magi, from whom the Clericus, C-L-E-A-R-C-H-U-S, from whom Clericus very erroneously derives the former, the Pythagoreans, the Sufis, and the Rishis of Kashmir, instituted a kind of international and universal Freemasonry among their esoteric societies. These Rishis, says Higgins, are the Essenians, Carmelites or Nazarites of the temple, Anacalypis, Anacalypis, that occult science known by ancient priests under the name of regenerating fire, says Father Ribauld, a science that for more than 3,000 years was the peculiar possession of the Indian and Egyptian priesthood, into the knowledge of which Moses was initiated at Heliopolis, where he was educated, and Jesus among the Essenian priests of Egypt or Judea, and by which these two great reformers, particularly the latter, wrought many of the miracles mentioned in the scriptures. In the notes taken by a traveler whose episode with the monks on Mount Athos we have mentioned elsewhere, we find that during his early life, Jesus had frequent intercourse with the Essenes belonging to the Pythagorean school and known as the Kohen Novi. It is an abuse of privilege when an author who claims to write historical facts draws convenient deductions from hypothetical premises and then calls it a biography, a life of Jesus. I got a call. Hold on. No more than any other compiler of legends concerning the problematical history of the Nazarene prophet has Renan, one inch of secure foothold upon which to maintain himself, nor can anyone else assert as a claim to the contrary, except on inferential evidence. And yet, while Renan has not one solitary fact to show that Jesus had never studied the metaphysical tenets of Buddhism and Parsism, or heard of, notice Parsism, okay, Iran, Persia, Pars, and I'll cover more on the source of Judaism in the future. Okay, Jesus had never, okay, I'm going to start over. And yet, while Renan has not one solitary fact to show that Jesus had never studied the metaphysical tenets of Buddhism and Parsism, or heard of the philosophy of Plato, his opponents have the best reason in the world to suspect the contrary. When they find that, number one, all his sayings are in a Pythagorean spirit, when not verbatim repetitions. Number two, his code of ethics is purely Buddhistic. Number three, his mode of action and walk in life, Essenian. And number four, his mystical mode of expression, his parables, and his ways, those of an initiate, whether Grecian, Chaldean, or Magian, were of the same school of arcane learning the world over. It is difficult to escape from the logical conclusion that he belonged to that same body of initiates. Now, there was also a parenthesis in there. I read part of it because I thought it fit, but I'm going to read the whole parenthesis so you'll grasp it further. For the perfect, this is after Magian, Magi, who spoke the hidden wisdom, were of the same school of archaic learning the world over. In the very first remark made by Jesus about John the Baptist, we find him stating that he is Elias, which was for to come. This assertion, if it is not a later interpolation for the sake of having a prophecy fulfilled, means again that Jesus was a Kabbalist, unless indeed we have to adopt the doctrine of the French Spiritists and suspect him of believing in reincarnation. Except the Kabbalistic sects of the Essenes, the Nazarenes, the disciples of Simeon ben Iochia and Hillel, neither the Orthodox Jews nor the Galileans believed or knew anything about the doctrine of permutation. Thus, Jesus hinting that John was the revolutio or transmigration of Elias seems to prove beyond any doubt the school to which he belonged. Let me relight this cigarette and cough. While it is evidently to the Essenes, hold on, that belongs the honor of having had the Nazarene reformer, Jesus, as a pupil, still the latter is found disagreeing with his early teachers on several questions of formal observance. He cannot strictly be called an Essene, for reasons which we will indicate further on. Neither was he a Nazar or Nazaria of the older sect, thus the phrase Nazarene and the town of Nazareth. What Jesus, and of course Nazareth was probably created to justify Jesus, what Jesus was may be found in the Codex Nazaraeus, Nazaraeus, Codex Nazaraeus, in the unjust accusations of the Bardisanian Gnostics. Bardisanian. Bardisanian Gnostics. Jesus is Nebu, the false Messiah, the destroyer of the old Orthodox Church, says the Codex. He is the founder of the sect of the new Nazars and, as the words clearly imply, a follower of the Buddhist doctrine. In Hebrew, the word Naba means to speak of inspiration and is Nebo, a god of wisdom. But Nebo is also Mercury, and Mercury is Buddha in the Hindu monogram of planets. Moreover, we find the Talmudists holding that Jesus was inspired by the genius of Mercury. The Nazarene reformer had undoubtedly belonged to one of these sects, though perhaps it would be next to impossible to decide absolutely which. But what is self-evident is that he preached the philosophy of Buddha Sakyamuni, denounced by the later prophets, cursed by the Sanhedrin, the Nazars. They were confounded with others of that name who separated themselves unto the shame. They were secretly, if not openly, persecuted by the Orthodox synagogue. It becomes clear why Jesus was treated with such contempt from the first and deprecatingly called the Galilean. Nathanael inquires, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? John 1:46. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth at the very beginning of his career, and merely because he knows him to be a Nazar? Does not this clearly hint that even the older, Nazars were not really Hebrew religionists, but rather a class of Chaldean theurgists? Besides, as the New Testament is noted for its mistranslations and transparent falsification of text, we must justly suspect that the word Nazareth was substituted for that of Nazaria Nozari, N-O-Z-A-R-I, that it originally read, "Can any good thing come from a Nozari or Nazarene, a follower of St. John the Baptist, with whom we see him associating from his first appearance on the stage of action, after having been lost sight of for a period of nearly 20 years. The blunders of the Old Testament are as nothing to those of the Gospels." Nothing shows better than these self-evident contradictions the system of pious fraud upon which the superstructure of the messiahship rests. "This is Elias, which was for to come," says Matthew of John the Baptist, thus forcing an ancient Kabbalistic tradition into the frame of evidence. And that's 11:14. Superstructure of the Messiah, I'm sorry, evidence 11:14. That's Matthew 11:14. "But when addressing the Baptist himself, they ask, 'Art thou Elias?' And he said, 'I am not.' Which knew best, John or his biographer? And which is divine revelation?" And that was John 1:16. The motive of Jesus was evidently like that of Gautama Buddha, to benefit humanity at large by producing a religious reform which should give it a religion of pure ethics, the true knowledge of God and nature having remained until then solely in the hands of the esoteric sects and their adepts. As Jesus used oil and the Essenes never used aught but pure water, he cannot be called a strict Essene." And the Essenes considered oil as a defilement, says Josephus in his book Wars, 2, page 7. On the other hand, the Essenes were also a set apart. They were healers, or asaya, and dwelt in the desert, as all ascetics did. I need to call. Hold on. "But although he did not abstain from wine, he could have remained a Nazarene all the same. For in chapter 6 of Numbers, we see that after the priest has waved a part of the hair of a Nazarite for a wave offering before the Lord, after that a Nazarene may drink wine." Verse 20. The bitter denunciation by the reformer of the people, who would be satisfied with nothing, is worded in the following exclamation. "John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, 'He hath a devil.' The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Behold, a man gluttonous and a winebibber.' And yet he was an Essene and Nazarene, for we not only find him sending a message to Herod to say that he was one of those who cast out demons, who performed cures, and actually calling himself a prophet and declaring himself equal to other prophets." The author of Sod, S-O-D, shows Matthew trying to connect the appellation of Nazarene with the prophecy, and inquires, "Why then does Matthew state the prophet said he should be called Nazari?" And that's in Matthew 2. "Simply because he belonged to that sect, and a prophecy would confirm his claim to messiahship. Now it does not appear that the prophets anywhere state that the Messiah will be called the Nazarene." The fact alone that Matthew tries in the last verse of chapter 2 to strengthen his claim that Jesus dwelt in Nazareth merely to fulfill a prophecy does more than weaken the argument. It upsets it entirely. For the first two chapters have sufficiently been proved later forgeries. We must bear in mind that the gospel according to Matthew in the New Testament is not the original gospel of the apostle of that name. The authentic evangel was for centuries in the possession of the Nazarenes and the Ebionites, and we shall show further on the admission of St. Jerome himself, who confesses that he had to ask permission of the Nazarenes to translate it. To assure ourselves that Jesus was a true Nazarene, albeit with ideas of a new reform, we must not search for the proof in the translated Gospels, but in such original versions as are accessible. Tischendorf, in his translation from the Greek of Luke 4:34, has it, Iesou Nazarene, I-E-S-O-U, Nazarene. And in the Syriac, S-Y-R-I-A-C, it reads, Iesou thou Nazari. Thus, if we take into account all that is puzzling and incomprehensible in the four Gospels, revised and corrected as they now stand, we shall easily see for ourselves that the true original Christianity, such as was preached by Jesus, is to be found only in the so-called Syrian heresies. Only from them can we extract any clear notions about what's primitive Christianity. When the metaphysical conceptions of the Gnostics, who saw in Jesus the Logos and the Anointed, began to gain ground, the earliest Christians separated from the Nazarenes, who accused Jesus of perverting the doctrines of John and changing the baptism of the Jordan directly, says Milman, as it, the gospel, got beyond the borders of Palestine and the name of Christ had acquired sanctity and veneration in the eastern cities. He became a kind of metaphysical impersonation. While the religion lost its purely moral cast and assumed the character of a speculative theogony, the only half-original document that has reached us from the primitive apostolic days is the Logia of Matthew. The real genuine doctrine has remained in the hands of the Nazarenes in this Gospel of Matthew, containing the secret doctrine, the sayings of Jesus mentioned by Papias. These sayings were no doubt of the same nature as the small manuscripts placed in the hands of the neophytes, who were candidates for the initiation into the mysteries, and which contained the aporetta, A-P-O-R-R-H-E-T-A, the revelations of some important rites and symbols. For why should Matthew take such precautions to make them secret were it otherwise? Okay, I'm going to go to the next page and light a cigarette. Hold on, let me light this stogie. Okay, that the apostles had received a secret doctrine from Jesus and that he himself taught one is evident from the following words of Jerome, who confessed it in an unguarded moment. Writing to the bishops Chromatius and Heliodorus, he complains that a difficult work is enjoyed since this translation has been commanded me by your felicities, which St. Matthew himself, the apostle and evangelist, did not wish to be openly written. For if it had not been secret, he, referring to Matthew, would have added to the evangel that which he gave forth was his, but he made up this book sealed up in Hebrew characters, which he put forth even in such a way that the book written in Hebrew letters and by the hand of himself might be possessed by the men most religious, who also, in the course of time, received it from those who preceded them. But this very book they never gave to anyone to be transcribed, and its text they related some one way and some other. And he adds further on the same page, and it happened that this book, having been published by a disciple of Manichaeus, named Seleucus, L-E-S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S, who also wrote falsely the Acts of the Apostles, exhibited matter not for edification, but for destruction, and that this book was approved in a synod, which the ears of the church properly refused to listen to. He admits himself that the book, which he authenticates as being written by the hand of Matthew, a book which, notwithstanding that he translated it twice, was nearly unintelligible to him, for it was arcane or a secret. Nevertheless, Jerome coolly sets down every commentary upon it, except his own, as heretical. More than that, Jerome knew that his original Gospel of Matthew was the expounder of the only true doctrine of Christ, and that it was the work of an evangelist who had been the friend and companion of Jesus. He knew that if of the two Gospels, the Hebrew in question and the Greek belonging to our present scripture, one was spurious, hence heretical. It was not that of the Nazarenes, and yet knowing all this, Jerome became more zealous than ever in his persecutions of the heretics. Why? Because to accept it was equivalent to reading the death sentence of the established church. The gospel, according to the Hebrews, was but too well known to have been the only one accepted for four centuries by the Jewish Christians, the Nazarenes, and the Ebionites, and neither of the latter except the divinity of Christ. If the commentaries of Jerome on the prophets, his famous Vulgate, and their numerous polemical treatises are all trustworthy as this version of the gospel according to Matthew, then we have a divine revelation indeed. Let me take a drag. Why wonder at the unfathomable mysteries of the Christian religion, since it is perfectly human? Have we not a letter written by one of the most respected fathers of the church to this same Jerome, who shows better than whole volumes of their traditionary policy that this is what St. Gregory of Nazianzen, this is what St. Gregory of wrote to his friend and confidant St. Jerome. Okay, let me reread that. This is what St. Gregory wrote to his friend and confidant. Okay, it probably should be confidant. St. Jerome. Nothing, this is what he said. Nothing can impose better on a people than verbiage. The less they understand, the more they admire. Our fathers and doctors have often said, not what they thought, but what circumstances and necessity forced them to. Pretty amazing, isn't it? This search after truth leads us, indeed, into devious ways. Many of the obstacles that ecclesiastical cunning has placed in the way of our finding the primal source of religious ideas. Christianity is on trial, and has been, ever since science felt strong enough to act as public prosecutor. A portion of the case we are drafting in this book, What of Truth Is There in This Theology? Through what sects has it been transmitted? Whence was it primarily derived? To answer, we must trace the history of the world religion, alike through the secret Christian sects, as through those of other great religious subdivisions of the race. For the secret doctrine is the truth, and that religion is nearly divine that has contained it with least adulteration. Hold on just one sec. I had to turn my air conditioner back on here. Now I got a cough. Hold on. This search after truth leads us, indeed, into devious ways. Many of the obstacles that ecclesiastical cunning has placed in the way of our finding the primal source of religious ideas. Oh, I've already read that. Sorry. Next paragraph. We can assert with entire plausibility that there is not one of these sects, Kabbalism, Judaism, and our present Christianity included, but sprung from the two main branches of that one mother trunk, that the once universal religion which antedated the Vedic Age, V-E-D-A-I-C, Vedic Ages. We speak of that prehistoric Buddhism, which merged later into Brahmanism. Go back to my last two shows. The religion which the primitive teaching of the early few apostles most resembled, a religion preached by Jesus himself, is the elder of these two, Buddhism. In the Nazarene or Bartasanian system, which may be termed the Kabbalah within the Kabbalah, the Ancient of Days, Antiquus Altus, who is the father of the demiurgus of the universe, is called the Third Life or Avatar, and he is the father of Phetahil, Phetahil, who is the architect of the visible universe, which he calls into existence by the powers of his genie, at the order of the greatest, the Avatar answering to the father of Jesus in the later Christian theology. These two superior lives, then, are the crown within which dwells the greatest Pharaoh, F-E-R-H-O, before any creature came into existence, the Lord Pharaoh existed. And that's out of Codex Nazareus 1, page 145. One by one, the tide of time engulfed the sects of early centuries until the whole number, only one survived in its primitive integrity. That one still exists, still teaches the doctrine of its founder, still exemplifies its faith in works of power. The quicksands which swallowed up every other outgrowth of the religious agitation of the time of Jesus, with its records, relics, and traditions, proved firm ground for this. Driven from their native land, its members found refuge in Persia, and today the anxious traveler may converse with the direct descendants of the disciples of John, who listened on the Jordan shore to the man sent from God and were baptized and believed. This curious people, at the time written, numbering 30,000 or more, are miscalled Christians of St. John, but in fact should be known by their old name of Nazareans, or their new one, Mendaeans, M-E-N-D-A-E-A-N-S. To term them Christians is wholly unwarranted. They neither believe in Jesus as a Christ, nor accept his atonement, nor adhere to his church, nor revere its holy scriptures. Neither do they worship the Jehovah God of the Jews and Christians, a circumstance which, of course, proves that their founder, John the Baptist, did not worship him either. And if not, what right has he a place in the Bible or in the portrait gallery of Christian saints? Still further, if Ferho was his God, and he was a man sent by God, he must have been sent by Lord Ferho, and in his name baptized and preached. Now, if Jesus was baptized by John, the inference is that he was baptized according to his own faith. Therefore, Jesus, too, was a believer in Pharaoh, or Pharaoh, F-H-A-O, as they call him, a conclusion that seems the more warranted by his silence to the name of his father. And why should the hypothesis that Pharaoh is but one of the many corruptions of Pho, F-H-O, or F-O, Pho, as the Tibetans and Chinese call Buddha, appear ridiculous? In the north of Nepal, Buddha is more often called Pho than Buddha. What the actual Baptists, or El Moctasila, or Nazareans, do believe is fully set forth in other places, for they are the very Nazarenes of which we have spoken so much, and from whose codex we have quoted. Persecuted and threatened with annihilation, they took refuge in the Nestorian body and so allowed themselves to be arbitrarily classified as Christians. But as soon as opportunity offered, they separated and now for several centuries have not even nominally deserved the appellation. But where else can science find so good a field for biblical research as among this two neglected people? No doubt of their inheritance of the Baptists' doctrine, their traditions are without a break. What they teach now, their forefathers taught at every epoch where they appear in history. They are the disciples of that John who is said to have foretold the advent of Jesus, baptized him, and declared that the latchet of his shoe he was not worthy to unloose, meaning John was not worthy to unloose. Now, before I continue, you'll notice Baphomet relates to the word baptize and Johannite. We'll get into the Baphomet at a later point, not in this show, but another one. As they two, the messenger and the Messiah, stood in the Jordan, and the elder was consecrating the younger, his own cousin, too, humanly speaking, the heavens opened, and God himself, in the shape of a dove, descended in a glory upon his beloved son. How then, if this tale be true, can we account for the strange infidelity which we find among these surviving Nazareans? So far from believing Jesus, the only begotten Son of God, they actually told the Persian missionaries, who in the 17th century first discovered them, to Europeans, that the Christ of the New Testament was a false teacher, and that the Jewish system, as well as that of Jesus, came from the realm of darkness. Who knows better than they? Where can more competent living witnesses be found? Christian ecclesiastics would force upon us an anointed Savior, heralded by John, and the disciples of this very Baptist from the earliest centuries have stigmatized this ideal personage as an impostor, and his putative father, Jehovah, a spurious god, the Elda Boeth of the Ophites. Unlucky for Christianity will be the day when some fearless and honest scholar shall persuade their elders to let him translate the contents of their secret books and compile their oral traditions. Spelled H-O-A-R-Y, probably meaning oral. It is a strange delusion that makes some writers think that the Nazareans have no other sacred literature. So other literary relics than four doctrinal works, and that the curious volume full of astrology and magic which they are bound to pursue at the sunset hour on every Souls Day, S-O-L, or Sunday. I need to cough, clear my throat, hold on. Both pagan philosophy and Christianity, however, owe their elevated ideas on the soul and spirit of man and the unknown deity to Buddhism and the Hindu Manu. No wonder that the Manichaeans maintained that Jesus was a permutation of Gautama, the Buddha. Christ and Mani were one and the same person, for the teachings of the former two were identical. It was the doctrine of old India that Jesus held to when preaching the complete renunciation of the world and its vanities in order to reach the kingdom of heaven, Nirvana, where men neither marry nor are given in marriage, but live like the angels. Gautama Buddha is mirrored in the precepts of Christ. In the sacred Jaina books, J-A-I-N-A, of Patuna, the dying Gautama Buddha is thus addressed: Arise into Nirvai, or Nirvana, from this decrepit body into which thou hast been sent. Ascend into thy former abode, O blessed avatar. This seems to use the very opposite of nihilism. Seems to us the very opposite of nihilism. If Gautama is invited to reascend into his former abode, and this abode is Nirvana, then it is incontestable that Buddhistic philosophy does not teach final annihilation. as Jesus is alleged to have appeared to his disciples after death. So they present day, so to the present day, Gautama believed to descend from Nirvana. And if he has an existence there, then this state cannot be a synonym for annihilation. If both are aware of the great danger of furnishing an uncultured populace with a double-edged weapon of knowledge, which gives them power, left the innermost corner of the sanctuary in the profoundest shade, who, that is acquainted with human nature, can blame them for it? But while one was actuated by prudence, the other was forced into such a course. Gautama left the esoteric and most dangerous portion of the secret knowledge untouched and lived to the ripe old age of 80, with the century of having taught the essential truths and having converted them one-third of the world. Jesus promised his disciples the knowledge which confers upon man the power of producing far greater miracles than he himself did ever did himself. Sorry, than greater miracles than he ever did himself. And he died, leaving but a few faithful men, only halfway to knowledge, to struggle with the world to which they could impart but what they halfway knew themselves. Later, their followers disfigured truth still more than they themselves had done. There never was a greater religious reform that was not pure at the beginning. The first followers of Buddha, as well as the disciples of Jesus, were all men of the highest morality. The aversion felt by the reformers of all ages to vice under any shape is proved in the case of Sakyamuni, Pythagoras, Plato, Jesus, St. Paul, Ammonius, Saccas. Okay, there's a little footnote here. And I'll see if I'm going to read this here. Give me a second. I need a cough as well. Okay, I'll read this. Mere recitance is not a sign of wisdom. It is one of wisdom's tools. Okay, be sure and catch this in the archives. We're down to almost running out of the two-hour show right here. It is one of wisdom's tools, no more. It is volubility upon occasion, or smile, a laugh, or any other expression, mode, means, or method. Wisdom itself is no means. It uses all means. Wisdom is distilled knowledge, high operative intelligence, and since every human being represents his own peculiar combination of qualities, changing each moment with every expression and impression, wisdom utilizes the proper tool for the particular moment, operating under principle and with design, but using means concordant with the end in view. Thus, to judge the wisdom of anybody, whatever, from a superficial point of view, is to make a mistake. The wise often mask their wisdom with an unalloyed simplicity. Now, we'll go to the next section, and again, catch the archives. Now, I'm going to light a cigarette at the same time. Okay, the next page, and it's probably going to wind up going into another show the way it looks. I don't know that I'm going to be able to get through all through 12 of these. I'm on number 3 right now, and so there's 9 more of these pages afterwards. Some of them are shorter than others, but, you know, some of them are a little longer than what I read here before. So anyway, let me light the smoke. Drop out from Christianity the personality of Jesus, so sublime, because of its unparalleled simplicity and what remains. History and comparative theology echo back the melancholy answer, a crumbling skeleton formed of the oldest pagan myths. While the mythical birth and life of Jesus are a faithful copy of those of the Brahmanical Krishna, his historical character of a religious reformer in Palestine is the true type of Buddha in India. In more than one respect, their great resemblance in philanthropic and spiritual aspirations, as well as external circumstances, is truly striking. Through the son of a king, while Jesus was but a carpenter, Buddha was not of the high Brahmanical caste by birth. Like Jesus, he felt dissatisfied with the dogmatic spirit of the religion of his country. the intolerance and hypocrisy of the priesthood, their outward show of devotion, and their useless ceremonials and prayers. As Buddha broke violently through the traditional laws and rules of the Brahmins, so did Jesus declare war against the Pharisees and the proud Sadducees. What the Nazarene did as a consequence of his humble birth and position, Buddha did as a voluntary penance. He traveled about as a beggar, and again, like Jesus later in life, he sought by preference the companionship of publicans and sinners. Each aimed at a social as well as at a religious reform and giving a death blow to the old religions of his countries, and each became the founder of a new one. Okay, I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to play a song here, and I'll be right back. Let's see here. Here's a good one.
Love.
Okay, I'm back. I just want to remind everybody that, Buddha did not exist. And so go back and listen to my past couple of shows if you've missed it. Okay, I'll pick up where I left off here. The reform of Buddha, says Max Mueller, had originally much more of a social than of a religious character. The most important element of Buddhist reform has been its social and moral code, not its metaphysical theories. That moral code is one of the most perfect which the world has ever known. And he whose meditations had been how to deliver the soul of man from misery and the fear of death, had delivered the people of India from a degrading thraldom and from priestly tyranny. Further, the lecturer adds that were it otherwise, Buddha might have taught whatever philosophy he pleased, and we should hardly have heard his name. The people would not have minded him, and this system would only have been a drop in the ocean of philosophic speculation by which India was deluged at all times. The same with Jesus. While Philo, whom Renan calls Jesus' elder brother Hillel, Shammai, and Gamaliel, are hardly mentioned, Jesus has become a god, and still pure and divine as was the moral code taught by Christ, it could never have borne comparison with that of Buddha, but for the tragedy of Calvary. That which helped forward the deification of Jesus was his dramatic death, the voluntary sacrifice of his life, alleged to have been made for the sake of mankind. And the later convenient dogma of the atonement invented by the Christians, in India, where life was valued as of no account, the crucifixion would have produced little, if any, effect. We see that the Golden Rule was not original with Jesus and that its birthplace was India. Do what we may, we cannot deny Sakyamuni Buddha, a less remote antiquity than several centuries before the birth of Jesus, in seeking a model for his system of ethics. Why should Jesus have gone to the foot of the Himalayas rather than to the foot of the Sinai? But the doctrines of Manu and Gautama harmonized exactly with his own philosophy, while those of Jehovah were to him abhorrent and terrifying. The Hindus sought to reform good for evil, but the Jehovistic command was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Hold on, I need to cough. If the Mosaic Lord God was the only living God and Jesus his only son, how account for the rebellious language of the latter? Without hesitation or qualification, he sweeps away the Jewish lex tax leonis and substitute for it the law of charity and self-denial. If the Old Testament is a divine revelation, how can the New Testament be? Are we required to believe and worship a deity who contradicts himself every few hundred years? Was Moses inspired, or was Jesus not the Son of God? This is a dilemma from which the theologians are bound to rescue us. It is from this very dilemma that Gnostics endeavored to snatch the budding Christianity. Justice has been waiting 19 centuries for intelligent commentators to appreciate this difference between the Orthodox Tertullian and the Gnostic Marcion. We are quite ready to show the Lord God of Israel the same respect as we do Brahma, Zeus, or any other secondary deity, but we decline most emphatically to recognize in him either the deity worshipped by Moses or the father of Jesus, or yet the ineffable name of the Kabbalist. Jehovah is, perhaps, one of the Elohim, who was concerned in the formation, which is not the creation, was concerned in the formation of the universe, one of the architects who built from pre-existing matter, but he never was the unknowable cause that created Bara, B-A-R-A, in the night of eternity. Laying aside the theological disputes of Christianity, which try to blend together the Jewish creator of the first chapter of Genesis with the Father of the New Testament, Jesus states repeatedly of his Father that he is in secret. Surely he would not have so termed the ever-present Lord God of the Mosaic books, who showed himself to Moses and the patriarchs, and finally allowed all the elders of Israel to look on himself, Exodus 14, 9, and 10. When Jesus is made to speak of the temple at Jerusalem as of his Father's house, he does not mean the physical building, which he maintains he can destroy, then again rebuild in 3 days, but of the temple of Solomon, the wise Kabbalist, who indicates in his Proverbs that every man is the temple of God or his own divine spirit. This term of the Father who is in secret we find used as much in the Kabbalah as in the Codex Nazareus and elsewhere. No one has ever seen the wisdom concealed in the cranium, and no one has beheld the depth or the bythos, B-Y-T-H-O-S, Simon the Magus preached, one Father unknown to all. And again, Solomon is not a real person, and there's actually theoretically a connection to the stories about him in the Egyptian, and I believe it's from the 18th dynasty. Plato considered the divine nature under a threefold modification of the first cause, the reason, or logos, and the soul or spirit of the universe. The three archaeal or original principles, says Gibbon, were represented in the Platonic system as three gods united with each other by a mysterious and ineffable generation. That's from the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Blending this transcendental idea with the more hypostatic figure of the Logos of Philos, of Philo, rather, whose doctrine was that of the oldest Kabbalah and who viewed the King Messiah as the Metatron, or the angel of the Lord, the Legatus, descended in flesh, but not the ancient of days himself. The Christians clothed with this mystical representation of the mediator for the fallen race of Adam, Jesus, the son of Mary. And that was spelled L-E-G-A-T-U-S, by the way, Legatus. Under this unexpected garb, his personality was all but lost. In the modern Jesus of the Christian church, we find the idea of the imaginative Irenaeus, not the adept of the Essenes, the obscure reformer from Galilee. We see him under the disfigured Plato-Polonian mask, not as the disciples heard him on the mount. If we now recall the fact that a portion of the mysteries of the pagans consisted of the apropheta, or divine disclosures, that the secret logia, or discourses of Jesus contained in the original gospel according to Matthew, the meaning and interpretation of which St. Jerome confessed to be a difficult task for him to achieve, were of the same nature, and if we remember further that to some of the interior or final mysteries, only a very select few were admitted, and that finally it was from the number of the latter that were taken all the ministers of the holy pagan rites, we will then clearly understand this expression of Jesus quoted by Peter. Guard the mysteries for me and the sons of my house, in other words, of my doctrine. If we understand it rightly, we cannot avoid thinking that this secret doctrine of Jesus, even the technical expressions of which were but so many duplications of the Gnostic and Neoplatonic mystic phraseology, that this doctrine, we say, was based on the same transcendental philosophy of Oriental Gnosis as the rest of the religions of those in earliest days. That none of the latter Christian sects, despite their boasting, were the inheritors of it, is evident from the contradictions, blunders, and clumsy repatching of the mistakes of every preceding century by the discoveries of the succeeding one. The ascetic observation of the Christian Sabbath by Protestants is pure religious tyranny and does more harm, we fear, than good. It really dates only from the enactment in 1678 of the 29th of Charles II, which prohibited any tradesman, artificer, workman, laborer, or other person to do or exercise any worldly labor, etc., etc., upon the Lord's day. The Puritans carried this thing to extremes, apparently to mark their hatred of Catholicism, both Roman and Episcopal. That it was no part of the plan of Jesus that such a day should be set apart is evident not only from his words but acts. It was not observed by the early Christians. When Trypho, the Jew, reproached the Christians for not having a Sabbath, what does the martyr answer him? The new law will have you keep a perpetual Sabbath. You, when you have passed a day in idleness, think you are religious. The Lord is not pleased with such things as these. If any be guilty of perjury or fraud, let him reform.
if he be an adulterer, let him repent, and he will then have kept the kind of Sabbath truly pleasing to God. The elements are never idle and keep no Sabbath. There was no need of the observance of Sabbaths before Moses. Neither now is there any need of them after Jesus Christ. From the birth of the solemn and majestic conceptions of the unrevealed deity of the ancient adepts to such caricatured descriptions of him who died on the cross for his philanthropic devotion to humanity, long centuries have intervened, and their heavy tread seemed to have almost entirely obliterated all sense of a spiritual religion from the hearts of his professed followers. Okay, next page, and I'm going to cough and light a cigarette here, so just one sec. Okay. This is the fourth section of the 12 that we've got. Hang on a second, let me light this. Okay. And I'm not sure how I will handle getting through all of this, but it's quite clear I'm not going to make it through the 3 hours for this show to get it all in. But we'll get it wrapped up one way or another. In what particular does the jealous, wrathful, revengeful God of Israel resemble the unknown deity, the God of mercy preached by Jesus, his Father who is in heaven and the Father of all humanity? This Father alone is the God of spirit and purity, and to compare him with the subordinate, capricious, sinaitic deity is an error, meaning the Sinai deity. Did Jesus ever pronounce the name Jehovah? Did he ever place his Father in contrast with the severe and cruel judge, his God of mercy, love, and justice, with the Jewish genius of retaliation? Never. From that memorial day, when he preached his Sermon on the Mount, an immeasurable void opened between his God and that other deity who fulminated his commands from that other mount, Sinai. The language of Jesus is unequivocal and implies not only rebellion but defiance of the Mosaic Lord God. He had heard, he tells us, that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Ye have heard that it hath been said by the same Lord God on Sinai, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. And that's out of Matthew chapter 5. Again, this is those are not my words. This is the call article. When dying on the cross, the martyred man of sorrows forgave his enemies. His last words were a prayer in their behalf. He taught his disciples to curse not, but to bless, even their foes. There was but one apostle of Jesus worthy of name, and that was Paul. However disfigured were his epistles by dogmatic hands before being admitted into the Canaan, the conception of the great and divine philosopher who died for his idea can still be traced to his addresses to the various Gentile nations. Only he who would understand him better yet must study the Philonian logos reflected now in the then Hindu Sabbata or logos of the Mimamsa school. And by the way, the book Peace of Christ that I've mentioned before actually refers to Paul as being a later emperor after Titus. And in other words, they went in there later at a later point and revised the book with Paul's doctrine. And of course, one can argue that if you read Paul's doctrine as it's written, it's certainly not superior to what was being taught by this Jesus, but it's clear that it's been obviously altered. In the writings of Paul, the entity of man is divided into a trine, flesh, physical existence, or soul, and the overshadowing and at the same time interior entity of spirit. His phraseology is very definite. when he teaches the anastasis, or the continuation of life, of those who have died. He maintains that there is a physical body which is sown in the corruptible, and a spirit body that is raised in incorruptible substance. Jesus makes the heart what Paul says of the flesh. Alas, alas, how little has the divine seed scattered broadcast by the hand of the meek Judean philosopher thrived or brought forth fruit. He who himself has shunned hypocrisy, warned against public prayer, showing such contempt for any useless exhibition of the same, could he but cast his sorrowful glance on the earth from the regions of eternal bliss, we would see that this seed fell neither on sterile rock nor by the wayside. Nay, it took deep root in the most prolific soil, one enriched even to the plethora with lies and human gore. If the alleged founder of the Christian religion is now, after the lapse of 19 centuries, preached, and more or less unsuccessfully, however, in every corner of the globe, we are at liberty to think that the doctrines attributed to him would astonish and dismay him more than anyone else. A system of deliberate falsification was adopted from the first. And the memory of the meek and lowly Jesus still lingered lovingly in every Christian heart, and his words of mercy and charity vibrated still in the air. Even then, the Christians were outdoing the pagans in every kind of ferocity and religious intolerance. Truly, says Bishop Kidder, were a wise man to choose his religion from those who profess it, perhaps Christianity would be the last religion he would choose. And by the way, I've always said that you'd never be able to convert a Buddhist to Christianity. They would just look at it and laugh. Renan makes of Jesus a sort of sentimental ninny, a theatrical simpleton, enamored of his own poetical divagations and speeches, wanting everyone to adore him, and finally caught in the snares of his enemies. Such was not Jesus, the Jewish philanthropist, the adept and mystic of a school now forgotten by the Christians and the church, if ever it was known to her, the hero who preferred even to risk death rather than withhold some truths which he believed would benefit humanity. It is in Palestine that we have to search for the clearest waters of Christianity, let alone its source. The first Christians, after the death of Jesus, all joined together for a time, whether they were Ebionites, Nazarenes, Gnostics, or others. They had no Christian dogmas in those days, and their Christianity consisted in believing Jesus to be a prophet. This belief varying from seeing in him simply a just man or a holy, inspired prophet, a vehicle used by Christos and Sophia to manifest themselves through. These all united together in opposition to the synagogue and the tyrannical technicalities of the Pharisees, until the primitive group separated into two distinct branches, which we may correctly term the Christian Kabbalist of the Jewish Tanaim school, T-A-N-A-I-M, and the Christian Kabbalist of the Platonic Gnosis. The former were represented by the party composed of the followers of Peter and John and the author of the Apocalypse. The latter ranged with the Pauline Christianity, blending itself at the end of the second century, when the Platonic philosophy and engulfing, still later, the Gnostic sects, whose symbols and misunderstood mysticism overflowed the Church of Rome. Amid this jumble of contradictions, what Christian is secure in confessing himself such? Next section. Let's see here. Okay. I got a call. Hold on. Okay. I need to just double check something here real quick. Hold on. Okay. All right, let me go back to that previous page. Okay, in the Clementine recognitions, the charge is brought against Jesus that he did not perform his miracles as a Jewish prophet, but as a magician, i.e., an initiate of the heathen temples It was usual then, as it is now, among the intolerant clergy of opposing religions, as well as among the lower classes of society, and even among the patricians, who for various reasons had been excluded from any participation of the mysteries, to accuse sometimes the highest hierophants and adepts of sorcery and black magic. One of the best and most unquestionable proofs of our assertion may be found in the so-called Museo Gregoriano. On the sarcophagus, which is paneled with bas-reliefs representing the miracles of Christ, it may be seen the figure of Jesus, who in the resurrection of Lazarus appears beardless and equipped with wand in the received guise of a necromancer, which the corpse of Lazarus is swathed in bandages exactly as an Egyptian mummy. No one ever seems to make that connection. Had posterity been enabled to have several such representations executed during the first century, when the figure, dress, and everyday habits of the reformer were still fresh in the memory of his contemporaries, perhaps the Christian world would be more Christ-like. The dozens of contradictory, groundless, and utterly meaningless speculations about the Son of Man would have been impossible, and humanity would now have but one religion and one God. It is this absence of all proof, the lack of the least positive clue about him whom Christianity has deified, that has caused the present state of perplexity. No pictures of Christ were possible until the days of Constantine, when the Jewish element was nearly eliminated among the followers of the new religion. And by the way, the Eastern Orthodox Church still forbids that, if I believe. And there was a schism between Rome and the Byzantine Empire on that issue, and Rome saw it necessary to have graven images in order to be able to use as a tool of conversion. And of course, no graven images is Jewish. The division of the history of mankind into golden, silver, copper, and iron ages is not a fiction. We see the same thing in the literature of peoples. An age of great inspiration and unconscious productiveness is invariably followed by an age of criticism and consciousness. The one affords material for the analyzing and critical intellect of the other. Thus, all those great characters who tower like giants in the history of mankind, like Buddha, Siddhartha, and Jesus in the realm of spiritual, and Alexander the Macedonian, and Napoleon the Great in the realm of physical conquest, were but reflexed images of human types which had existed 10,000 years before in the preceding decimillennium, reproduced by the mysterious powers controlling the destinies of our world. There is no prominent character in all the annals of sacred or profane history whose prototype we cannot find in the half-fictitious and half-real traditions of bygone religions and mythologies. As the star glimmering at an immeasurable distance above our heads in the boundless immensity of the sky reflects itself in the smooth waters of a lake, so does the imagery of men of the antediluvian ages reflect itself in the periods we can embrace in an historical perspective. As above, so it is below. That which has been will return again, as in heaven, so on earth. It was given to a contemporary of Jesus to become the means of pointing out to posterity, by his interpretation of the oldest literature of Israel, how deeply the Kabbalistic philosophy agreed in its esotericism with that of the profoundest Greek thinkers. The contemporary and ardent disciple of Plato and Aristotle was Philo Judaeus. While explaining the Mosaic books according to a purely Kabbalistic method, he is the famous Hebrew writer whom Kingsley calls the father of the new Platonism, Platonism. It is evident that Philo's therapeutes are a branch of the Essenes. Their name indicates it, Asaya, physician, A-S-A-Y-A. Hence the contradictions, forgeries, and other desperate expedients to reconcile the prophecies of the Jewish Canaan with the Galilean nativity and godship. Luke, who was a physician, is designated in the Syriac text in Asaya, A-S-A-I-A, the Essenian or Essene. Josephus and Philo Judaeus have sufficiently described this sect to leave no doubt in our mind that the Nazarene reformer, after having received his education in their dwellings in the desert, had been duly initiated in the mysteries, preferred the free and independent life of a wandering Nazarite, and so separated or in-Azarenized himself from them, thus becoming a traveling therapeute, a Nazaria, a healer. Every therapeute, before quitting his community, had to do the same. Both Jesus and St. John the Baptist preached the end of the age, which proves their knowledge of the secret computation of the priests and Kabbalists, who, with the chiefs of the Essene communities alone, had the secret of the duration of the cycles. The latter were Kabbalists and Theragists. They had their mystic books and predicted future events, said Monk. The real meaning of the division into ages is esoteric and Buddhistic. So little did the uninitiated Christians understand it that they accepted the words of Jesus literally and firmly believed that he meant the end of the world. There had been many prophecies about the forthcoming age. Virgil, in the fourth Eclogue, mentions the Metatron, a new offspring with whom the Iron Age shall end and a golden one arise. Dunlap, whose personal researches seem to have been quite successful in that direction, traces the Nazarenes, Essenes, the Scythians, and some other sects as having all existed before Christ. They rejected pleasures, despised riches, loved one another, and more than any other sects, neglected wedlock, deeming the quest of passions to be virtuous, he says. These are all virtues preached by Jesus, and if we are to take the Gospels as a standard of truth, Christ was a metempsychosis. Christ was a psychoist. Christ was a metempsychoist or reincarnationist. Again, like these same Essenes, whom we see were Pythagoreans in all their doctrines and habits. Iamblichus asserts that the Samian philosopher spent a certain time at Carmel with them. In his discourses and sermons, Jesus always spoke in parables and used metaphors with his audience. This habit was again that of the Essenians and the Nazarenes, and the Galileans, who dwelt in cities and villages, were never known to use such allegorical language. Indeed, some of his disciples, being Galilean as well as himself, felt even surprised to find him using with the people such a form of expression. "Why speakest thou unto them in parables?" they often inquired. "Because it is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not," was the reply, which was that of an initiate. "Therefore I speak unto them in parables, because they seeing see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand." Moreover, we find Jesus expressing his thoughts still clearer and in sentences which are purely Pythagorean, when during the Sermon on the Mount he says, "Give ye not that which is sacred to the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, for the swine will tread them under their feet, and the dogs will turn and rend you." The religion of the ancients is the religion of the future. A few centuries more, and there will linger no sectarian beliefs in either of the greatest religions of humanity. Brahmanism and Buddhism, Christianity and Mohammedanism will disappear before the mighty rush of facts. "I will pour out my spirit upon all the flesh," writes the prophet Joel. "Verily I say unto you, greater works than these shall you come, greater works than these shall you do," promises Jesus. But this can only come to pass when the world returns to the grand religion of the past, the knowledge of these majestic systems which preceded it. By far, Brahmanism and even the primitive monotheism of the ancient Chaldeans, that which is now termed the superstitious verbiage and gibberish of mere heathens and savages, composed many thousands of years ago, may be found to contain the master key to all religious systems. It was after the rebellion of Bar Kokhba, C-O-H-B-A, that the Roman emperor established the mysteries of Adonis at the sacred cave in Bethlehem, and who knows but this was the Petra, or rock temple, on which the church was built. The boar of Adonis was placed above the gate of Jerusalem, which looked toward Bethlehem. Monk said that the Nazarite was an institution established before the laws of Musa. This is evident as we find this sect not only mentioned but minutely described in the book of Numbers, chapter 6. In the commandment given in this chapter to Moses by the Lord, it is easy to recognize the rites and laws of the priests of Adonis. The abstinence and purity strictly prescribed in both sects are identical. Both allow their hair to grow long, as the Hindu Koenobites and Fakirs, I believe is how you say it, F-A-K-I-R-S, the Fakirs do to this day, while other castes shave their head and abstain on certain days from wine. The prophet Elijah, a Nazarene, is described in 2 Kings and by Josephus as a hairy man girt with a girdle of leather, and John the Baptist and Jesus are both represented as wearing very long hair. John is clothed with camel's hair and wearing a girdle of hide, and Jesus is in a long garment without any seams and very white like snow, says Mark. The very dress worn by the Nazarene priest and the Pythagorean and Buddhist Essenes, as described by Josephus. In relation to the well-known fact of Jesus wearing his hair long and being always so represented, it becomes quite startling to find how little the unknown editor of the book of Acts knew about the Apostle Paul, since he makes him say in 1 Corinthians 11:14, "Doth not nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him?" Certainly Paul could never have said such a thing. Therefore, if the passage is genuine, Paul knew nothing of the prophet whose doctrines he had embraced and for which he died. And if false, how much more reliable is what remains? In a pretended letter of Lentulus, a senator and distinguished historian to the Roman Senate, there is a description of the personal appearance of Jesus. The letter itself, written in horrid Latin, is pronounced a bare-faced forgery, but we find therein an expression which suggests many thoughts. Albeit a forgery, it is evident that whoever invented it has nonetheless tried to follow tradition as closely as possible. The hair of Jesus is represented in it as wavy and curling, flowing down from his shoulders, and as having a parting in the middle of the head after the fashion of the Nazarenes. The last sentence shows, number one, that there was such a tradition based on the biblical description of St. John the Baptist, the Nazarite, and the custom of this sect. Two, had Lentulus been the author of this letter, it is difficult to believe that Paul should never have heard of it, and had he known its contents, he would never have pronounced it a shame for men to wear their hair long, thus shaming his Lord and Christ God. Number three, if Jesus did wear his hair long and parted in the middle of the forehead after the fashion of the Nazarenes, as well as John, the only one of the apostles who followed it, then we have one good reason more to say that Jesus must have belonged to the sect of the Nazarenes and been called Nazaria. For this reason, and not because he was an inhabitant of Nazareth, for they never wore their hair long. The Nazarite, who separated himself unto the Lord, allowed no razor to come upon his head. He shall be holy, and shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow, says Numbers 6, verse 5. Samson was a Nazarite, in other words, vowed to the service of God, and in his hair was his strength. by the final and most reasonable conclusion to be inferred from this is that Jesus, who was so opposed to all the Orthodox Jewish practices, would not have allowed his hair to grow had he not belonged to this sect, which in the days of John the Baptist had already become a heresy in the eyes of the Sanhedrin. Jesus, Apollyonus, and some of the apostles had the power to cast out devils by purifying the atmosphere within and without the patient, so as to force the unwelcome tenant to fight. The accusations against Jesus of practicing the magic of Egypt were numerous, and at one time universal in the towns where he was known. The Pharisees, as claimed in the Bible, had been the first to fling it in his face, although Rabbi Wise, W-I-S-E, considers Jesus himself a Pharisee. We believe that it was the Sadducees and not the Pharisees who crucified Jesus. They were Zadokites, partisans of the house of Zadok, or the Sacer, S-A-C-E-R-D-O-T-A-L, sacerdotal family in the house of Zadok. In the book of Acts, the apostles were said to be persecuted by the Sadducees, but never by the Pharisees. In fact, the latter never persecuted anyone. They had the scribes, rabbis, and learned men in their numbers, and were not, like the Sadducees, jealous of their order. The Talmud certainly points to James the Just as one of that sect. But these partisans are known to have always stoned every prophet who denounced their evil ways, and it is not on this fact that we base our assertion. These accused him of sorcery and of driving out devils by Beelzebub, their prince, with as much justice as later the Catholic clergy had to accuse of the same more than one innocent martyr. But Justin Martyr states on better authority that the men of his time who were not Jews asserted that the miracles of Jesus were performed by magical art. At the very expression used by the skeptics of those days to designate the feats of the thaumaturgy accomplished in the pagan temples, thaumaturgy, T-H-A-U-M-A-T-U-R-G-Y, they even ventured to call him a magician and a deceiver of the people, complains the martyr. In the Gospel of Nicodemus, or the Acti Pilate, that's A-A-C-A, Pilate, the Jews bring the same accusation before Pilate. Did we not tell thee he was a magician? Celsus, C-E-L-S-U-S, speaks of the same charge, and as a Neoplatonist believes in it. The Talmudic literature is full of the most minute particulars, and their greatest accusation is that Jesus could fly as easily in the air as others could walk. St. Austin asserted that it was generally believed that he had been initiated in Egypt and that he wrote books concerning magic, which he delivered to John. There was a work called Magi Jesu Christi, which was attributed to Jesus himself. In the Clementine Recognitions, the charge is brought against Jesus that he did not perform his miracles as a Jewish prophet, but as a magician, in other words, an initiate of the heathen temples. Jesus is accused by his enemies of having wrought miracles and shown by his own apostles to have expelled demons by the power of the ineffable name. The former firmly believe that he had stolen it in the sanctuary, and he cast the spirits with his word and healed all that were sick. And that's in Matthew 18:16. When the Jewish rulers asked Peter in Acts 4:7, by what power or by what name have ye done this? Peter replies, by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. But does this mean the name of Christ, as the interpreters would make us believe, or does it signify repeatedly that all he does in his Father's name and not his own? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and end here. We'll pick this up at another later point. Not sure how it'll work out yet. Let me go back to the studio and read my notes here. Let me get to my notes. And here we go. Okay, so again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? I'll close out with some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan, and we will close out with some Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Flair.
Satan! Satan!